Matthew chapter 1 verses 1 through 17. The first talk in a series on the Gospel of Matthew was presented by Ron Julian on March 1, 2015 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2015. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Well, good evening. A French skeptic who himself did not believe in the miracles of Jesus nevertheless once said, "The Gospel of Matthew, taken all in all, is the most important book of Christianity, the most important book that was ever written." It would be hard to overestimate the impact Matthew has had on our culture. Let me just throw some lines at you here. "Love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. It is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. Observe how the lilies of the field grow. They do not toil, nor do they spin. Yet I say to you that not even Solomon in all his glory clothed himself like one of these. Ask, and it will be given to you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and it will be opened to you. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and unto God what is God's. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. All who live by the sword shall die by the sword. Do not give what is holy to dogs, and do not throw your pearls before swine. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you." These words from the Gospel of Matthew and many others have burrowed their way deeply into our culture. But as important as Matthew is historically and culturally, that's not why you and I are about to study Matthew. Now, I hope you will forgive me for spoiling the end of the book here, but the very last thing we see in Matthew is Jesus, risen from the dead, saying, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth." Well, if that's true, and I believe it is, then we would do well to find out more about this Jesus. And of course, that is Matthew's purpose, to tell us who Jesus is, what he taught, what he did, what he wants from us. So we're going to be going through Matthew. I'm planning on doing this for quite a while. I'm going to take a very leisurely pace through Matthew. We're just going to talk about what we need to talk about, and maybe 10 years from now, I'll be done. Before we start looking at chapter 1, there is some information about the book of Matthew that I think will be helpful to know. First of all, you probably know Matthew is one of four books, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, that tell the story of Jesus. And the first thing that we notice when we read these four books is that three of them are very similar, very similar. Matthew, Mark, and Luke are very much alike. They tell a lot of the same stories, and they tell these stories using very similar words, sometimes exactly identical words. Now, there are also differences between Matthew, Mark, and Luke. In Matthew, 20% of the material is unique to Matthew. You won't find it in the other two Gospels. But still, that means that 80% of Matthew is repeated in Mark or Luke or both. The Gospel of John, on the other hand, is very different. There is very little that is shared in common between John and the other three Gospels. Now, our purpose is to study Matthew, but I think it's actually very helpful for us to think a minute about some differences between the Gospel of John and the other three Gospels, Matthew included. And actually, I want to highlight one important difference between John and the other Gospels. There are many that would be informative, but there's one I think that will help us get off on the right foot. This difference will help us understand something very important about the Gospel of Matthew as we go through it. The issue I want to look at is how these books present the relationship between Jesus and the city of Jerusalem. The city of Jerusalem was the center of Jewish worship. The temple of God was there at the time Jesus was living. During the major festivals, Jews would flock to Jerusalem, and Jerusalem was located in the region of Judea. Jesus, however, did not live in Judea. He lived in Galilee in the north. Judea was in the south, then Samaria was above that, and then Galilee was above Samaria. The distance from Jesus' hometown in Galilee to Jerusalem was about the same as the distance from Eugene to Salem. Now, the Jews in Jerusalem, in Judea, did not have a great attitude toward the Jews in Galilee. They were fellow Jews, but they didn't think too highly of them. They thought Galilean Jews were too influenced by Gentile Greek culture. There were a lot of towns that were Gentile towns around them. Galilean Jews were not pious enough. Galilee was not even in the same country as Judea. Galilee had its own ruler, Herod Antipas, but Judea was ruled directly by its Roman conquerors. Judea had a Roman governor named Pontius Pilate, whom you've probably heard of. The Galilean Jews had a funny accent. One person tells Peter that he must be one of those Galileans who were with Jesus because even the way you talk, he says, gives you away. There's something about the way the Galileans talked that made it obvious that they were from Galilee. All in all, Galilee was considered to be relatively unimportant by the Judeans in comparison with Judea and Jerusalem. If Jerusalem is at the center of Jewish life, Galilee is out on the edges. So the fact that Jesus was from Galilee was a big problem, a bigger problem than might be obvious to us. These are just Bible names that we've heard. Oh yeah, Galilee and Sea of Galilee and Judea and Jerusalem. But there was a tension between those regions. Here's a guy claiming to be the long-awaited savior of the Jewish people, and he came from Galilee. The Judean Jews may have, this may be exaggerating, but they may have looked down on him the way a New Yorker might look down on a guy from Alabama. He comes from a culturally inferior place, and he has a funny accent. So, the fact that Jesus did not live in or near Jerusalem, but rather in Galilee, is an important part of his story. Now, here's the way the Gospel of John tells the story of Jesus' relationship with Jerusalem. So Jesus, as we say, he lives in Galilee. So John portrays him traveling to Jerusalem for the festival of the Passover. While he's there, he goes into the temple and throws out the merchants and throws down their tables and whips their animals to make them leave and gets a lot of people mad. He talks with a guy named Nicodemus, who seems very interested in what Jesus is saying. Then Jesus travels north through Samaria and back to Galilee, his home base. He returns to Jerusalem for another festival then, John says. This time, he heals a man on the Sabbath day. And the leadership in Jerusalem is so outraged at what they consider a violation of God's law that they want to kill Jesus. So Jesus, knowing this, returns to Galilee again. He stays away from Jerusalem because he knows that people are seeking to kill him. But somewhat secretly, he returns to Jerusalem for another festival, the Feast of Booths. There is great turmoil. Some think Jesus is great. Others think he's terrible. The Jewish leadership sends officers to try to arrest him at this time, but the officers get caught up in what he's saying, and they don't arrest him. And they come back and say, that guy was cool. We really enjoyed listening to him. At least twice on this visit to Jerusalem, crowds pick up rocks to stone Jesus to death, but he escapes. So Jesus leaves Jerusalem again. However, he hears that his friend Lazarus is sick, and so he returns to Jerusalem. Lazarus by this time is dead. Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead, and this really gets the Jewish leadership worried. Now people are really going to be listening to this guy. And so they have a big meeting, and they resolve that they're going to kill Jesus. Jesus withdraws from the city a bit, but he returns as Passover is drawing near, and it is on this last visit that he is arrested and executed. So as John portrays it, Jesus makes a number of trips to Jerusalem and then back to Galilee, or sometimes to other places. Perhaps he went for every Jewish festival, and there were three major festivals a year. Each time he met new people and made new disciples, and each time he did new things that made the leadership more and more determined to kill him. So Jesus' eventual execution is a result of tensions that had built up between Jesus and the Jewish leadership over the course of a number of visits to Jerusalem. That is how John portrays the relationship of Jesus living in Galilee with the leadership in Jerusalem. But now, let's compare that with how the other three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, portray this. These Gospels say nothing about Jesus making numerous back and forth trips to Jerusalem. They don't deny that he did this, they just don't mention it. Instead, the first half of these three Gospels is set in Galilee and the surrounding regions. Jesus teaches and does miracles in the area of Galilee in the north. Toward the end of the Galilean ministry, each of the three Gospels has exactly the same dramatic turning point in the story. Jesus asks his disciples who they think he is, and his disciple Peter says, "You are the Christ." After this, Jesus begins telling his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem, be killed, and rise again. As it is often described, Jesus turns his eyes toward Jerusalem. The second half of these three Gospels is about Jesus' journey to Judea and Jerusalem. Jesus enters into Jerusalem and is finally arrested and executed. This is most clear in Mark and Matthew. It's a little less clear in Luke, but still, fundamentally, that's the way it's portrayed. So we see that Matthew, Mark, and Luke present Jesus' story with a very different structure than John does. John describes numerous trips back and forth between Galilee and Jerusalem. The other three Gospels have this two-part structure. First, the ministry in Galilee. Then Jesus turns his eyes toward Jerusalem, travels there, and is ultimately killed and rises again. Now, each of the three books has that same structure. They're very similar in this way, and there are a lot of similarities in their structure. We don't know for certain whether it was Matthew, Mark, or Luke, or who first decided to tell Jesus' story in this way. Most scholars think Mark wrote first. That's probably right. I don't myself know quite how to answer that question, but they're probably right. There are other arguments that can be made, but let's concentrate on Matthew here now. What is clear with the structure that I described there, and as we look further into the Gospel of Matthew, what is clear is that Matthew is not just reciting the events of Jesus' life. He is shaping his story, organizing it to bring out the significance of the events he's talking about. Now, I'm not saying that Matthew was mistaken or lying about Jesus' life. He never claimed to have told everything Jesus ever did in the exact order that he did it. But what is clear is that Matthew wants to tell the story in a way that highlights certain truths. Jesus' life is portrayed as a journey from Galilee to Jerusalem. And that is a profoundly true insight into what happened. Jesus starts in the lowly region of Galilee and then turns his eyes toward Jerusalem, the center of the Jewish religion, where he will be rejected, killed, and rise again. That is an accurate and important way to think about Jesus' life. What I want to emphasize then is this. As we go through Matthew, this is the perspective that I have on the book. Matthew is organizing things to bring out themes and connections. He is telling the truth about what Jesus said and did, but he is not writing a biography. He is not marching chronologically through the events of Jesus' life. He has organized his story to bring out the theological significance of what Jesus taught and did. There is a lot of debate as to whether there is a deliberate structure to the book of Matthew. Many different proposals have been made. I went and looked at a number of commentaries to see what proposals they would make, and every single one of them proposed a different structure for Matthew, which makes it obviously a little difficult to be dogmatic on that topic. But I think we can safely say this. Matthew presents Jesus' ministry with this two-part structure that I was talking about. First, his ministry in Galilee. Then there is a turning point where he turns his eyes toward Jerusalem. The second part of the book is his journey toward Jerusalem, toward his death and resurrection. There's another interesting feature about the structure of Matthew. There are five places where Matthew presents a major chunk of Jesus' teaching. These are the places that in your red letter edition look the most red on the pages. Although you will find that there's a lot of red in Matthew. It's not that there isn't teaching in other places as well. They're sometimes referred to as the five discourses. Discourse one is the Sermon on the Mount. Discourse two is Jesus giving instructions as he sends out his disciples to do ministry. Discourse three is Jesus telling parables about the kingdom of God. Discourse four is Jesus telling his followers how they should relate to one another. And Discourse 5 is the Olivet Discourse, where Jesus talks about the future. I think it is pretty clear that Matthew does this self-consciously. That is, he is aware that he has presented five bodies of teaching, each one thematically unified. Interestingly, he ends each discourse with similar-sounding language, something like, "And it came about when Jesus finished these words," almost like a formal marker that says, "Thus endeth the lesson." So, putting this all together, we might describe the structure of Matthew as something like this, in very simple terms. There are preliminaries, Jesus' birth, John the Baptist, and so forth. Section 1, then, is Jesus' ministry in Galilee. In this section, we have three discourses, the Sermon on the Mount, the sending out of the disciples, and the kingdom parables. Surrounding these discourses are stories about Jesus' miracles and his interactions with people. And as we see as we go along, there may be thematic connections between the narrative part of the story and the discourse in that section. That'll be a question for us to talk about as we go along. Then we have the turning point. Jesus, in talking to his disciples, starts talking about how he must go to Jerusalem to die and be raised again. So he turns his eyes toward Jerusalem and his ultimate fate. The second part of the book is the journey to Jerusalem and what happened there. In this section, there are two discourses, a discourse on how believers should relate to each other, and then, when Jesus arrives at Jerusalem, the Olivet Discourse. Here Jesus talks about the future, including his prediction of the destruction of the temple. And then the section culminates in the death and resurrection of Jesus. I might refine this picture as we go along, as I study Matthew further, but right now, something like this makes sense to me as to what it is that Matthew's doing. Okay, there's one other question that I should probably address, but unfortunately I don't have much to say about it. The question is, who wrote Matthew and when was it written? This is the sort of thing that you're supposed to talk about with a book in the Bible. Who wrote it and when was it written? The problem is that we don't have a lot of evidence to go on here. Right now, I accept the tradition that Matthew, one of Jesus' disciples, wrote this gospel. It doesn't say in the text itself who it is that wrote it. This is different than the Gospel of John, where there are a number of hints in the text that the author of the Gospel of John is John, although he never names himself by name. He refers to himself as the disciple whom Jesus loved. But the disciple whom Jesus loved is the one who has written the account that we see in John. Matthew doesn't have any sort of hint like that. What it has on the texts that we have is a heading that the four Gospels each have. It says, according to Matthew, according to Mark, according to Luke, according to John. And it seems fairly clear that those titles were put on when the four Gospels were joined together, were collected together as a unit. So, do we know for certain that Matthew wrote it? We don't. I don't have any strong reason to question whether he did. I don't really know how much difference it makes ultimately. And if I had to vote, I would say that it was written before the temple was destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD. That's also controversial. You find people who go put the date early, put the date late. If that's right, that means that it was written less than 40 years after the resurrection of Jesus. This is about the same amount of time since I first met Jack in California. So I find myself thinking, could I write an account of when I first met Jack in California? I think I could. I still have a few brain cells left. I can still sort of remember what was going on back there. I seem to recall that Jack really had... Never mind. I was going to make something really bad up, and then I just decided I shouldn't do that. So I take that entirely back. Okay, so it's very difficult to be certain about these questions of authorship and date when it comes to Matthew. What is pretty clear is that the authority of this gospel was accepted from a very early date. Okay, so that's what I want to say about the background to the Gospel of Matthew. There is a lot that we could say about Matthew, but rather than telling you in advance, we will just try to bring it out as we go along through the book. So we're going to turn to Matthew now, chapter 1. Writers are often told that they should start with a bang. Writers should engage their audience. They should start with something really interesting. It might look like Matthew didn't get that memo. He starts his gospel with a genealogy, a list of the ancestors of Jesus. Could he have chosen anything more boring to start with? The boring nature of genealogies is almost a cliche. I mean, even when I was young, before I was a Christian, I somehow picked up from the culture this picture of people sitting in church trying to stay awake while the pastor is reading, Perez begat Hezron, and Hezron begat Ram, and Ram begat Amminadab. How can anybody even be interested in something like this? But I think, in actuality, that Matthew believes that he has started with a bang. He thinks this is really interesting stuff that he has done here. Important stuff. His genealogy hints at a fascinating story. A story that is relevant to every human being who has ever lived. But in order for Matthew's genealogy to have the power he intends, we have to know some things from the Old Testament. And actually, this is just in general terms the way it's going to be as we go through Matthew. Matthew expects his readers to be well acquainted with the Jewish scriptures. That's just what we have to deal with. And so as we go through Matthew, we will be constantly turning back to the Old Testament so we can understand what Matthew is saying. And this is true in a big way for the very first verse, Matthew 1:1, the record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. This is, in fact, as I understand what Matthew is saying, a powerful statement. But in order to understand its significance, we have to know what the Old Testament says about Abraham, about David, and about the Christ. Because as it turns out, Abraham and David are the most important ancestors in the history of the world. I guess if you don't count Adam, he's pretty important too. Abraham and David are absolutely the two people that it is most important for Jesus to be related to. So we'll start with Abraham. Abraham was a man chosen by God for extraordinary things. In Genesis 12:1, we read, "Now Yahweh said to Abraham, 'Go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth will be blessed." We'll talk specifically about this blessing to all the families of the earth in a minute. God's promise concerns Abraham's ancestors, but not all of them. The promise is passed down through Isaac, one of Abraham's children. In Genesis 26:4, God makes the same promise to Isaac. "Through your descendants, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed." And then the promise passes down to Jacob, one of Isaac's sons. This promise doesn't go to all of Isaac's sons. Specifically, it goes to Jacob. And in Genesis 28:14, God tells Jacob, "In you and in your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed." And of course, you're probably aware that Jacob has 12 children who are the fathers of the 12 tribes of Israel. So, what is this about? God is going to bless all the families, all the nations of the earth, through the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, the word blessed is a very religious-sounding word. What God is saying is that he is going to do something great, wonderful, desirable for all of the nations of the earth through the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The word nations is the source of our word Gentiles. There is always a distinction in the Jewish thinking presented in the Bible that there are the Jews and then there are the nations, those who are not the Jews, the Gentiles. So this is one of the first statements of God's intention to reach out not just to the Jews, the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but to the Gentiles as well. So as the book of Genesis ends, God has promised a great and wonderful blessing to all the nations of the earth, and this blessing will come through the Jewish people, the children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And Jesus, as Matthew tells us, is a son of Abraham. Matthew also tells us that Jesus is a son of David. And this brings us to the next phase of God's promises. David was a man chosen by God to be king over the Jewish people. But David's importance extends far beyond the fact that he was the king of Israel. God made a great promise to David, as great as the promise God had made earlier to Abraham. We find the entire promise spelled out in 2 Samuel chapter 7, but I'll just quote verse 16, which sort of sums it up. "Your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever. Your throne shall be established forever." And this is God talking to David. David is told that his descendants will sit on the throne forever. And again, this has significance that goes much farther than just Israel. David understands that ultimately his throne will rule all over the earth. And there are various passages that we could go to try to make that case, but I'll just ask you to take my word for it, that even David, in the start of this, had an understanding that this throne that God had put him on and was putting his descendants on was going to have an impact not just on the Jewish people, but the whole world. We can put it this way: God is going to bless the world through the throne of David. In fact, I would argue that David, as a descendant of Abraham, is a crucial part of how Abraham's descendants are going to bless the world. David and his sons are helping to bring the promised blessing of Abraham to the world through the throne of David. Who is it that's qualified to sit on the throne of David? A descendant of David, a son of David. And as Matthew tells us, Jesus is a son of David. Now, unfortunately, this promise to David didn't work out so well at first. David's descendants did go on to sit on his throne, first David's son, then his grandson, and so on. But some of these descendants of David were very bad kings. Many didn't do such a great job. Fairly quickly, the kingdom split, and a great portion in the north split away from the throne of David altogether, established their own kingdom. Ultimately, the entire nation fell into godlessness and evil, and God judged them by destroying the throne of David and sending the people into captivity in Babylon. Things were really looking bad. What happened to God's promise to David about his throne lasting forever? Well, God sent prophets to answer that question. The prophets said that God was still going to keep his promises to David. David's throne would last forever, but that would be because one king would come and sit on that throne forever. He would abolish evil, establish justice, bring peace, conquer death. One king would come and bring blessing to the entire world. This coming king came to be referred to as the Anointed One. The word Messiah comes from the Hebrew word that means Anointed One. The word Christ comes from the Greek word for Anointed One. So the Messiah, the Christ, is that one son of David that all of Israel was waiting for. He would rule over all the earth, bringing God's promised blessing to all the nations. All of this that I just said, I believe, is the background to the first verse of Matthew and the genealogy. Abraham was promised that his descendants would bring blessing to all the nations. David was promised that his descendants would rule over all the nations in peace. Those promises are fulfilled in Jesus. He is that one descendant of Abraham that will completely fulfill God's promise to bring blessing to the world. He is that one descendant of David that will bless the world by ruling over it in peace. Jesus is the promised king, the anointed one, the Messiah, the Christ. And that is what Matthew means when he says that he is giving the record of the genealogy of Jesus, the Christ, son of David, son of Abraham. Now, this story that I just told about Abraham, David, and the Christ is reflected in the structure of the genealogy that Matthew has put together. If you'll jump with me to verse 17, Matthew says, "So all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations. From David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations. And from the deportation to Babylon to the Christ, 14 generations." This genealogy, which records the ancestry of Jesus, is divided into three parts. Abraham was promised that blessing would come to the world through his descendants. The first part of the genealogy shows the progression from Abraham to David, who is a very crucial link in this chain of blessing. The second part of the genealogy is the list of the kings of Israel descended from David. The third part of the genealogy deals with the sorrowful time after the Jews are deported to Babylon. The throne of David is gone. David's descendants in this list are no longer kings. We are in that time where we are waiting for David's true son, the Messiah, the Christ, to make his appearance. And of course, that list culminates with Jesus, the Christ. So we can see that the first 17 verses of Matthew, the genealogy of Jesus, is in fact a kind of record in miniature of God's redemptive work in history. God promises Abraham that the world would be blessed through his descendants, so the first list is that of Abraham's descendants culminating in David. God's promises are now focused on David, who is promised that his descendants will sit on his throne forever and will bless the entire world through his rule. So the second list is that of the Davidic kings, those kings of Judah who were descended from David. But the line of kings comes to an end. All hope seems lost during the years when the people of Judah are deported to Babylon, the throne is thrown down, and people are waiting for the true king to come. And so the third list is the list of David's descendants who were not kings, waiting for the true king who was to come. And that hope is realized with the birth of Jesus, the Christ. This, I believe, is the fundamental message of this genealogy. This is the fundamental message of the first 17 verses of Matthew. Now, you may notice that we haven't talked about the specifics yet, the details of the genealogy. And that is because when you start looking at the details, it gets really sticky. The picture that I have just painted, I believe in very firmly. I think it's the way to think about this genealogy. When you start getting into the details is where all the questions start coming. Okay, now wait a minute. What's going on with that? There are so many questions that I would risk, I think, boring you to death if I were to go through all of the questions that there are about the details of this genealogy. So I've picked a couple of things to talk about that I hope will be helpful and interesting. There are many more questions besides these. It gets quite complicated, actually. So let me pick a couple of them just to bring to your attention. First question that we might look at, Matthew says that he has given three lists with 14 names each. So what's going on with that? What is that about? Well, for one thing, the way he is using numbers here is tricky. There are three lists of 14 names, he's saying. Well, I know how to multiply. 3 times 14 is 42. But there are only 41 names in this list. So did Matthew just mess up? He thought he was doing 42 names, but he left one out? There are numerous explanations for what it is Matthew is doing here. I've read a number of them. The one that makes the most sense to me, the simplest explanation, is that in verse 17, Matthew has actually explained what he's doing. Because in verse 17, he says that all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations. And if you go to the list and count Abraham first, David last, that's 14 names. Then he says, from David to the deportation to Babylon are 14 generations. If we take him at his word, what he's saying is he's used David twice. David is the last person in the first group of 14. David is the first person in the second group of 14. Now, what that tells us is that Matthew wasn't trying to actually count up the number of people. He was creating these 14 name lists for a mnemonic purpose, for memorization, for organization. He's not doing math here. It's an organizing principle that he's going by. So if he does what he says that he has done, then that explains why we only have 41 names, because David is used twice. David ends the first list from Abraham to David, and then David starts the second list. And this makes sense to me. If David starts the second list, then everyone on the second list was a full-fledged Davidic king. The second list is a list of kings of Judah, starting with David and then running down from there. The list ends with Josiah, if you count this way, who was the last person on the list to be a full-fledged king of Judah. That would make the final list then start with Jeconiah, who is also known as Jehoiakim in the Old Testament. He was conquered by the Babylonians and taken into captivity. Chronicles calls him Jeconiah the prisoner. And so the last list would be descendants of David who lost the opportunity to sit on David's throne until we get to the last name on the list, Jesus. Okay, now, did Matthew actually mean to say that historically there were exactly 14 people from Abraham to David, and then 14, not 15, not 13, but 14 people from David to Josiah, 14 people from Jeconiah to Jesus? That's an easy question to answer. No, he did not mean to say that. It's easy for us to see that he didn't mean that because his first two lists are derived from the book 1 Chronicles, the second and third chapters. Anyone who looks at 1 Chronicles will immediately notice that Matthew left several names off of that second list. He has not listed all of the kings of Israel in that list. I find it very difficult to believe that this was just a random mistake on his part. Where did he get this list in the first place? He got it. He's looking at 1 Chronicles when he's writing this down, and yet he has chosen to leave some names out. What happened as a result of his leaving the names out? Well, he's got 14 names on the list now. which I think is what he wanted to do. The first list from Abraham to David, as you pulled it out of the Old Testament, had 14 names on it. So let's have the next one be 14 and the third one be 14 so that it's easy to memorize and you know exactly what it is that's going on. At least that's a possible explanation for what he's doing. But what is clear is that he knows he's leaving things out. And I think it's quite likely it was a common thing to do in a genealogy. You didn't have to put everyone in the list. You can jump from someone's grandfather to them and not include the father, and it still preserves the line. It still shows you what the relationship is. You're just not listing every person in the list. So I doubt that there were only 14 people from Abraham to David. And in the last group, we don't know because we don't know who these people are. We have no idea where Matthew got the names that he has on the third list. We'll accept the first couple. But most of the names on that list, we don't know who they are or how Matthew knows who they are. So there are only 14 there. We wouldn't have the first clue as to how many people there were in that list. So my main point would be this. It seems clear to me that Matthew did not make a mistake with his numbers. He wanted to have 14 names in each list, even if it meant leaving some off. He repeated David twice, because in some ways David is the most important name on the list. This gives him three lists of 14 names each, the lineage from Abraham to David, the list of the Davidic kings, and then the list of the descendants of David who lost the opportunity to be king because of the deportation to Babylon until the true king, Jesus, arrived. Okay, now for question number two, and this gets really hairy. How does Matthew's genealogy compare to the genealogy that Luke gives in his gospel? I don't know if you know this, but there are two genealogies given for Jesus, one in Matthew and one in Luke. They are not the same. So this is a very difficult question to answer. Most of Luke's list is different from Matthew's. From Abraham to David is the same, but Luke, interestingly enough, does not list the kings who descended from David. So Matthew's list goes from David to Solomon, who is a son of David. But what's significant about Solomon is a son of David who was the next king of Israel. Luke goes from David to Nathan, who was another son of David, but was not a king. And the line of names then that follows from Nathan in Luke's list, they're all descendants of David, but none of them is a king of Israel or Judah. And then from there on, the names are almost completely different. And there are even complications to that, which I won't go into. There are various proposals for how to think about what's happening here. Now, one thing that we have to keep in mind is something that we haven't talked about yet, but we probably should talk about it now. There is something very unusual about this genealogy, and that's the last guy on the list, that is Jesus. Jesus is not a blood relative of his father Joseph. Both Matthew and Luke know that that's true. Both of them tell the story of the virgin birth of Jesus. We just ended at verse 17. Verse 18 is where Matthew starts telling the story of the virgin birth, so I don't think he forgot. I think he knows that that's the case. In fact, that's stupid. And we know that he knows that's the case because look at how Matthew puts it in the genealogy in verse 16. Jacob was the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, she by whom Jesus was born, who is called the Christ. So we have this person is the father of this person is the father of this person, until we get to Joseph. Joseph is not described as the father of Jesus, he's described as the husband of Mary, and Mary is the mother of Jesus. So this genealogy that we have here is a genealogy that's listing descendants one after the other, but at least one of them, the last one, is not a blood relative of the person who came before. Jesus is son of Joseph because Joseph, in marrying Mary, has accepted her son, Jesus, as his own. So Jesus has become a son of Joseph, not by being born of a union of Joseph and Mary, but because Joseph has married Mary and says, you know, your son is mine. So Jesus is a legal heir of Joseph, but he's not related to him by blood. So we know at least one person in Matthew's list is not, we're not talking about a blood relationship, we're talking about some other sort of legal relationship. So, with that in mind, we go back to our question then about the difference between Matthew's gospel and Luke's gospel. One explanation for the difference between Matthew and Luke is that Matthew gives Joseph's line and Luke gives Mary's line. This is a very popular explanation for the difference between the two genealogies. Jesus is physically related to David by this theory through Mary, and that's the line that we see in Luke. Jesus is legally related to the line of the Davidic kings through Joseph, and that's the genealogy that we see in Matthew. I would love it if that were true. That would be great. It would be really, it would solve a lot of problems, and it would be very fitting. I like it. And in fact, we know that Luke, it's very clear that Luke has interviewed Mary. Mary has given Luke a lot of information about what goes on. Everything relating to Jesus' early years is told from the perspective of Mary in Luke. It's told from the perspective of Joseph in Matthew. So what makes more sense than that Luke would have Mary's genealogy there because he had clearly gotten information from her and about her? The only problem is, and it's not an unsolvable problem, but it is a problem, is if you go and look at the genealogy in Luke, it doesn't say that it's Mary's genealogy. It says, it once again, it goes through Joseph. So how do I explain that this genealogy that doesn't mention Mary but does mention Joseph is actually about Mary? Well, there are various explanations that people give, and I won't go into all of that stuff. But you can see the problem. If Luke's genealogy is Mary's line that we're talking about, so Jesus is physically related to David through Mary, Jesus is legally related to the line of the Davidic kings through Joseph, if that's true, the problem is that Luke doesn't say so. So we have to come up with an explanation that gets us to that spot. Another possibility is that both genealogies are indeed for Joseph, but Matthew is giving the royal line through Solomon and the Davidic kings, and by this way of thinking, certain places in that line, like Jesus, certain places in that line are not blood relationships, but their relationship through adoption or Levirate marriage or various things, so that we don't see the bloodline in Matthew's, we see the right of succession, either through blood relationship or through adoption or whatever that comes down to Jesus. In Luke's genealogy, what we see is the actual bloodline from David to Joseph. Luke's genealogy then would be an actual blood relationship list that doesn't run through the kings, but finds its way going back to David. So Joseph is a legitimate descendant of David. Once again, it's hard to say what the answer to this question is. So I wish I could say more about that. It would be nice to know, but I don't know. And nobody really knows. Everyone has a different argument for how to explain what's going on with the difference between the two of them. If I remember correctly, we don't really know the names in Luke's list either. I mean, the ones from David, this is the number of names there are not known to us. There are a number of other interesting things we could talk about. I probably won't. I might just mention briefly that we do see, it is often commented by commentators that there are, besides Mary, there are four women who are mentioned in the list as being the mothers along with the fathers who are mentioned. It's sometimes said that that's a very unusual thing. I'm not quite sure that that's true because of the four women who are mentioned there, two of them are mentioned in the genealogy and chronicles that Matthew seems to be drawing on. So that it's not so unusual that the mother would be mentioned. What is perhaps interesting is, for example, that it says Salmon was the father of Boaz by Rahab. We don't know who that Rahab is, but if it's the Rahab that we know from the Old Testament, nothing else in the Bible says that that's true. This is new information, and it's hard to understand exactly how the dating would work and everything with that. But if that's true, then that's a very interesting thing, that in the line of the Messiah is this Canaanite woman who joined Israel and helped the spies when Israel went into the land, if you're familiar with that story. Ruth is also mentioned, and Ruth was a Moabitess, right? So here's someone who is not a Jew who is in the line of the Messiah. And it is interesting the way the Bible is not afraid to air its dirty laundry. David is described as the father of Solomon by Bathsheba, who had been the wife of Uriah. And behind that simple little statement, you probably know, is a sordid story about David having an affair with Uriah's wife and then sending him off into the battle to be killed so that he can have her for himself. So David, perhaps the most important name on this list, is also, there's a little side thing that says, you know, David had his problems. So those are interesting additions to the genealogy. They spice it up a little bit, make it, again, a window on the history of Israel that led into all of this stuff. But at this point, I'm going to stop with the details of the genealogy. If you have any of them you want to talk about, we could discuss them in the question and answer time. Let me just finish up by returning to this central message of the genealogy as I understand it. Matthew has started with a genealogy because God has made great promises to the world that are tied to a specific line of people. God is going to do great things for the entire world through the descendants of Abraham, and Jesus is that one descendant of Abraham who is most important in bringing these promises about. This theme is found elsewhere in the New Testament. The Apostle Paul in Galatians 3 says, "The Scripture, foreseeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith, preached the gospel beforehand to Abraham, saying, 'All the nations will be blessed in you.'" And this is that promise that we had read earlier in Genesis. And Paul goes on to say that Jesus died on the cross in order that in Christ Jesus, the blessing of Abraham might come to the Gentiles. Well, that's the promise that was made to Abraham, that there was a blessing that was going to come to the nations, to the Gentiles. And Paul is saying it is in Christ Jesus that that promise is fulfilled. Jesus Christ is the one who fully accomplishes what God had promised to Abraham. All the nations of the earth shall be blessed through him and his descendants. Likewise, God is going to do great things for the world through David and his descendants. And Jesus is that one descendant of David who will sit on the throne and fulfill the promises made to David. He will rule over all the earth in righteousness and peace. The New Testament is full of this theme. In Matthew, Jesus is called the Son of David multiple times. Toward the end of his life, Paul writes to Timothy, "Remember Jesus Christ, risen from the dead, descendant of David, according to my gospel." Paul can sum up his gospel in this simple way. According to my gospel, Jesus rose from the dead, and he is the descendant of David. In other words, he is that king who will sit on David's throne and rule over all creation forever. All of this is what Matthew is getting at in his genealogy, as I understand it. It takes a son of Abraham and a son of David to fulfill God's promises to the world, and that is what Jesus is. Matthew seems to think that this is a very big deal. His readers, who knew the Old Testament well, would understand why. God's promises were all about a complete restoration of the world. The world is full of sin and death and injustice and futility. And God was promising, through the descendants of Abraham and David, to transform the world into a place of righteousness and life and justice and fulfillment. He is going to do that through Jesus, the Christ, Son of David, Son of Abraham, whose story Matthew is about to tell next week. Okay, so we have a little time for any comments or questions you might have. I think it was pretty brave of me to preach on the genealogy in Matthew.
You're a courageous man. Hey, over here in verse 20, I've been asking all our teachers about this since
Christmas.
You mean
the verse that I didn't get to yet?
Yep.
Okay.
But it's relevant. The angel appearing in Joseph's dream addressed him as son of David.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So was that a comfort, a challenge, a reminder? Why did he not just say, Joseph, wake up, or Joseph,
right.
Joseph, son of David?
Right. Well, I am assuming what I will say on that is that the angel is alluding to the same sort of thing that Matthew is alluding to here. God is about to do something very unique in your family, son of David. A reminder that Joseph being in the line of David, it is not an unexpected thing that he would have an heir who could fulfill the promises that God made that were going to be fulfilled through a son of David along the line. So he's not saying that he is the coming Messiah, but he is saying, you are in the line of David, and that's significant for what I'm about to tell you. That's how I would understand it.
So does that validate the theory that the genealogy in Luke is indeed Joseph's genealogy?
Well, it all depends on how you think about it. Because Jesus is called a son of David, but he is not in this genealogy described as a blood relation. So being accepted as the heir of a Davidic, a person in the line of David, makes you a person in the line of David, as I understand it. So that could have happened in this list for Joseph. It might not be a blood relationship everywhere all the way back, but it would still make him a son of David. I see what you're saying. If that's true here, if this is the royal line and we don't have a blood relationship all the way to Joseph in this particular list, then does that mean that the Luke genealogy would have to be the blood relationship that would make Joseph a son of David? I don't think that would have to be. It may help to lean in that direction, I don't know, but I don't think it's necessary, actually, as I understand it. A non-blood relationship that is accepted by the Father as you are my heir is more important than a blood relative who has been disinherited. I mean, it's the acceptance of the Father, as I would understand it, that is the decisive thing.
These are very random questions, very strange questions.
Okay.
First of all, I vaguely remember having been taught or heard somebody teach that Joseph and Mary were related. Joseph and Mary, husband and wife, were related.
Well,
or is that just
random? No, that relates to how people answer the question, what is going on in Luke's genealogy as compared to Matthew? Because now, I mean, I haven't gone into all of the details of this, but you understand if you have two genealogies running here, that Joseph has a different father in Matthew than he does in Luke. How do we understand that? There are different ways that that can be true. If it is Joseph's line, one way that is proposed in explaining, well, this could be Mary's line, is that if it were true that Mary didn't have any brothers, then when Joseph, in marrying into the family, would have become the legal heir of her father. So in essence, he would become a son of Mary's father in that legally adopted, you're my heir sort of sense. And so he could be described as his father is this father in Matthew, which is his actual blood relative, and his father is this other guy in Luke because he has become the son of Mary's father through this marriage. People point to the fact, I forget where it is, it's somewhere in the Jewish writings somewhere from later on down the line. There's kind of a derogatory thing that is written about Mary. It is said, I don't know if, take this with a grain of salt, because I haven't explored this. This may be, you know, urban legend or something, I don't know. But what I've read in several places is that there's a place in the Jewish writing somewhere where this statement, this bad statement is made about Mary, and she's described as the daughter of Heli, I think it is. And isn't in Luke's genealogy, Joseph is the son of Eli. So that could be some sort of indication that we're really talking about Mary's father there, as in that relationship. So that's one way to talk about the relationship. Another, yeah, so I think I'm a little lost in all of the possibilities in there. But as I would understand it, the arguments about Joseph and Mary being related all derive from the various theories people have for trying to explain how did those genealogies come together in that place. You had another random question?
Yes. This is all pre-ancestry.com, you know,
right.
Pre-digital databases.
Right.
Do you know of what there was as a system, if there was any organized system, of keeping record of right. who begat who?
Well, I know what is said. This is not something that I've explored at great length, so I may be wrong about this too. But in the works that I have consulted, it is regularly said that the genealogical records of important families were kept in the temple, and that it is rumored that Herod the Great destroyed the genealogical records in the temple because he didn't want any pretenders to the throne. In particular, he didn't want anybody coming along claiming from the records that they were related to David so that they could say, see, I should be the rightful king or something like that. And in general, genealogical information was important, so it would be very likely that not only would the temple have records, but that families would have copies of those records and would be concerned to keep them. We have Ancestry.com right now, but Ancestry.com, you'll notice, is trying to sell us as a culture on the idea that, hey, you should be interested in these genealogical things. Nobody had to sell the Jewish people on the importance of ancestry, as I would understand it. So I think the incentive would be there to keep those records, to be interested in those records, much more than our culture is. Another question, comment?
It's a little curious. I mean, I might be wrong about this, but isn't the Jewishness of somebody about their mother? In other words, the lineages here are who, whether it's Mary
right.
or Joseph, but isn't it kind of important that Jesus is Jewish and
right.
that his mother would be Jewish?
Right.
And then the lineage would go back.
Right.
And it gets all messed up otherwise, right?
Right. No, well, I think that's right. But it's not a contradiction, I don't think. Yes, it was important that your mother was Jewish. I mean, it's important now, I know.
I just wondered if it was important then.
I think so. But the sort of genealogy that we're talking about, it was true that inheritance rights and all of that kind of stuff, that's going through the sons. So the argument is made, like for Luke's genealogy, if that is in fact Mary's line that we're looking at, why isn't her name there? Because a woman wouldn't be put in a genealogical list where you were trying to establish some sort of legal relationship or something like that. So the fact, it's more significant, like according to that one theory, it would be more significant that Joseph was accepted as an heir of Mary's father than that Mary was herself was the mother of Jesus. Although obviously it's hinted at. And yeah, so the genealogies are like other genealogies of the time and like other genealogies in the Old Testament, where it's the progression of the male line that they will record, although they will give the mother in some cases.
Is there any thematic source or reason for the genealogies that differs between Luke and Matthew? In other words, it seems like in Matthew you were suggesting the genealogy is to establish specifically the role of Jesus being the Messiah, who's the son of David, son mm-hmm. of Abraham, and receiver of the blessing and the ruler of the king, et cetera, et cetera. Is it the same in Luke, or is Luke doing something different?
I haven't looked at Luke as much. We should probably ask Jack. There are some things to note about Luke. It goes in the other direction. It goes backwards. This list culminates in Jesus. Luke's list starts with Jesus. And Luke's list does not go back to Abraham. It goes back to Adam. And in fact, it goes back to God, because Adam is described as the son of God. And so it is argued that you could argue that the purpose of the list is to more fully highlight Jesus' humanity, say that, you know, that he shares ancestry with Adam like we all do, or you know, those sorts of things. He doesn't divide it up the way Matthew does. Matthew's division just seems to make such sense thematically that it's hard to avoid. Luke doesn't do that sort of thing, so it's harder to say. But yeah, it is possible that the differences reflect a certain sort of a thing that Luke is trying to bring out. I don't know Luke well enough to know how to answer that. Do you have an opinion about that, Jack? No. Anything else? I'll leave you with one more strange little thing that happens in here then. You can picture the two genealogies as being like a figure eight, because at David they split, and there you have these two lines. But strangely enough, in the list where after Jeconiah, Matthew says, Jeconiah became the father of Shealtiel, and Shealtiel the father of Zerubbabel. Those are weird names, Shealtiel and Zerubbabel. Shealtiel and Zerubbabel are in Luke's list too. So if they're the same guys, the same two guys, then Luke and Matthew depart like this and then come back together at these two, but then after Zerubbabel, they part again, and then they meet again at Jesus or Joseph. So what's that about? I don't know. I mean, and then you can read various explanations. So how do you know, who's related to who? And why is it that, is it, which one is it? Is it Shealtiel, who is in Chronicles, it's listed, he's either the son of somebody or the brother of, so there are complications, again, that stuff of, are we looking at a bloodline or are we looking at someone who's been adopted and all of that sort of thing. It gets really interesting, and there are tons of them. But unresolved questions can ultimately leave you frustrated, so I won't leave you with any more unresolved questions. Son of Abraham, son of David, we got that. Okay, well, thanks. We'll start Christmas next week.